One of the core issues here is staffing shortages. And the issue with staffing shortages are that unlike PPE or ventilators, you can't really, you know, ramp up manufacturing of nurses. So there was a nurse I was talking to with the coronavirus and how contagious it is. Obviously, they can't bring the patient's families directly into the ICU. So it was their usual practice to use an iPad to FaceTime or video call loved ones in. Obviously, they don't think it's ideal, but it can still be a way for loved ones to say final goodbyes with dignity. This nurse, she had three patients instead of two, and these patients aren't stable. And so this nurse was working with the iPad and basically holding it in front of the patient's face just so that the family could have an intimate goodbye with them. When suddenly one of their two other patients, the alarm started going off, and they were literally in the heartbreaking position of having to pull the iPad away and end the video conversation early, because as important as it was for that patient to have what they needed, there was another patient where it was life or death. I am Tucker Doherty, and I am a health reporter with the health team here at Politico. It can be heartbreaking to have these conversations with nurses because they really care about their patients. They really care about the patient's family. And so it's a moment like that where these staffing shortages or these shortages of anything else these nurses need really hits home.
I'm Jeremy Siegel. This is Politico Dispatch. And today, months into the pandemic, healthcare workers tell Politico the lingering challenges that they face fighting the coronavirus and how those challenges are shifting as the virus spreads to new parts of the country. How did you and other Politico reporters get all of this insight into the on-the-ground situation at hospitals and other healthcare facilities?
So there are, of course, the types of contacts that we would interview in normal times, the head of hospital associations or public health experts, things like that. But we also really felt it was important with this pandemic to sort of establish direct lines to the doctors and nurses on the front lines. There are a lot of reasons for that, but I think the most important one for me is that especially once you verify who they are, they can ask for anonymity. They can be really honest because there's really no reason to sugarcoat it. And so I think a really good example of that for me is the issue of reusing PPE.
PPE, we hear, remains very strong, but we're encouraging healthcare workers to begin now to use some of the best practices that we learned in other parts of the country to preserve and to reuse the PPE supplies.
You might get really optimistic sounding information from public health authorities or the administration who say, yes, you know, we can sanitize these masks and preserve supply, and this is really going to be the thing that stops us from having shortages, and that's a great thing that we can sanitize this. So they'll be really optimistic. You talk to, you know, a hospital CEO or administrator, they might say things aren't great, we wouldn't be reusing these supplies if we didn't have to, but they'll defend the practice. And for them, you know, their hospital's reputation or their hospital's liability is on the line. It's when you talk to those doctors and nurses that you hear really unfiltered voices. You hear someone who's willing to say, you know, I think this is putting the patient in danger, or I think this is putting me in danger, or I'm thinking about quitting. And so to get those kinds of direct interviews, we've set up sort of a tip hotline, although it's more of an online survey that we've basically over the last few months gotten something about upwards of 500 direct written testimonies from doctors and nurses detailing the supplies they're running short of or what do they think public health authorities should do that they aren't doing. A lot of our reporting lately has been bolstered just by having lots and lots of one-on-one conversations with doctors and nurses who've given us enough information to verify who they are, and then to sort of just talk to them directly about, you know, what do they see in their day-to-day.
So with all of these interviews, all of these firsthand accounts from hospitals and other places, have any clear trend lines emerged of the situations at healthcare facilities?
Yes. So when people think about the front lines of the pandemic, they're thinking about hospitals, they're thinking about patients on ventilators and doctors and nurses in full medical gears attending to them. So a lot of our early fears about the pandemic were all about hospitals, you know, whether they would run out of ventilators or run out of beds, whether they had all the staff they need to work those ventilators, and so on and so forth. And a lot of the early efforts to funnel money and supplies were aimed at hospitals. And so we saw a lot of improvement in what doctors and nurses were telling us about the conditions at hospitals. But the number one thing we've learned about this virus is that it hangs around for a long time. And so as this pandemic has progressed, increasingly where the stress is not the hospitals, which are still doing a lot of intense work, but they increasingly have the PPE, they have the resources or staff that they need. It's all of the places that the patients go once they're at the hospital or where they are before they make it to the hospital. So whether we're talking about nursing homes or rehabilitation centers or assisted living communities, increasingly those are the places that when reporters talk to doctors or nurses or caregivers, they say, we're still having trouble getting all the masks we need. And so as other parts of the medical system, of the health system, are taking on these patients and taking on more responsibilities, they're the ones who are still struggling and can't get all of the protective equipment, can't get the trained staff. Relative to the hospitals, there's still a lot of struggle that just comes through in these interviews.
Where exactly are we seeing these disparities and these issues pop up? And what do you think it tells us about the trend of how the virus is spreading in the U.S.?
In some of my interviews with public health officials, one of the things that they've really drawn attention to is that in many ways, this pandemic has gone in the reverse of how they usually deal with pandemics. Usually, you see health issues crop up in communities that are more disconnected from the health system, because that is where a new infection or some sort of lingering issue might be building because of the disconnect from the health system and because people aren't getting vaccines or there are population health issues. With the coronavirus, it was sort of shockingly for a lot of these public health officials in the reverse. It was the urban centers. It was Manhattan, for example. Now, as the virus continues to grow, as cases sort of radiate out, it's increasingly hitting more low-income communities and more rural communities. The Southeast is really where you see a combination of those two features. The Mississippi Delta region, for example, where you already had long-standing issues with chronic health conditions and access to care and not having the hospitals or the beds. And now it's also spreading out in the West and Midwest. Really, really, truly rural places where there wouldn't be anything that you would call a major hospital for 100 miles in any direction. A lot of these places, they're implementing surge capacity, they're trying to hire nurses, they're converting regular beds to ICU beds. But at the end of the day, if you are in, you know, the middle of the Nevada desert or out in Wyoming or Idaho, to get the best care you need, you might need to be transported a fair distance to your state capital or to the nearest major hospital that has the advanced equipment and beds you need. The coordination is just very intense because the resources are unevenly distributed in a way that there's no easy answer for, because we are talking about some truly vast rural parts of the country that before this pandemic didn't necessarily have the resources or the population density or the financial support from the government to really have their own hospitals to rely on.
Tucker Dougherty, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me and talking about these important issues.
Also today, President Trump and Joe Biden are still trying to figure out their plans for their upcoming party conventions ahead of the November election. The DNC is set to take place virtually next week, but Biden and Democrats haven't finalized the convention schedule and who's going to talk live during the 8 hours of programming. Biden himself was set to speak from Milwaukee, but he now plans to do that from his home state of Delaware to avoid traveling during the pandemic. Meantime, President Trump, who announced last month that the Republican convention wouldn't happen in person in Jacksonville, says he'll give his speech from either the White House or the Civil War battlefield in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. If Trump were to speak from the White House, it'd break from long precedent in both parties of maintaining a separation between governing and politics. And a growing number of health officials are quitting or being fired during the coronavirus pandemic as they face mounting pressure, threats, and controversies within state and local health departments. At this point, dozens of state and local public health officials around the U.S. have either left their posts or been pushed out. Among the recent departures were Ohio's state health director, who resigned in June amid pressure from Republican lawmakers and after armed protesters showed up outside of her home, and West Virginia's public health commissioner, who was forced to resign by Governor Jim Justice over what he said were discrepancies in data. Just last week, New York City's health commissioner was replaced after months of friction with the police department and City Hall. And on Monday, California's public health director quit without explanation after a technical glitch that caused a delay in reporting virus test results. According to a review by Kaiser Health News and the Associated Press, at least 49 state and local public health leaders have resigned, retired, or been fired since April. Subscribe to Politico Dispatch wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you're hearing, tell a friend to listen and leave us a rating and review. That'll help other people find the show. I'm Jeremy Siegel. Thanks for listening.